content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. Begin today's program with an article from SmithsonianMag.com with an article about Charlotte Cushman broke barriers on her way to becoming the A-list actress of the 1800s by Tanya Wujcik. In the role of her lifetime, the queer performer was one of the first practitioners of method acting. "Stella," cries Marlon Brando, his contorted face and bare chest in an eloquent advertisement for thwarted love. We typically associate method acting with mid-20th century names like Brando and Lee Strasberg, and if we are theater nerds, with Stanislavski and the Moscow Art Theater. But the seeds of this transformative approach to theater, where actors draw on personal experience to evoke more realistic performances, were sown much earlier in the 19th century of writer Walt Whitman. In the 1840s, before he became a renowned poet, Whitman was a theater aficionado and wrote about New York plays and actors in his columns for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. One evening, he saw a new production of Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist at the prestigious Park Theater in downtown Manhattan and was amazed by a young actress named Charlotte Cushman, who was cast in the role of the prostitute Nancy. Cushman's performance was the most intense acting ever felt on the park boards, Whitman wrote, and no one saw her could help but marvel at the towering grandeur of her genius. Cushman would later become one of the most famous people in the world, America's first bona fide celebrity. But when Whitman first saw her, she was an up-and-coming performer. The role of Nancy was meant to be a fatal blow to her career. Cushman was a queer, masculine-looking actress with tremendous stage presence. She had angered at least one New York critic by beating out his girlfriend for roles, and her managers at the park disliked her, despite her talent. By the terms of her contract, Cushman had to take on any role her managers gave her, but she was furious when she read in the newspaper that they cast her as a prostitute. Nancy was not the plum role that it was thought then that it was today, and actresses were already thought of as little better than prostitutes by the moralizing public. Newspaper man Horace Greeley's Tribune often railed against the moral dangers of the theater, which did allow prostitutes to service customers in the famous third tier. Cushman came up with a plan. Without telling anyone, she ventured into New York's infamous Five Points neighborhood, where most of the city's prostitutes actually lived. Similar in size and squalor to the slums Dickens evoked in Oliver Twist, Five Points housed the city's immigrant poor, and it was where most single women arrived and later died as women of ill repute. With very few jobs available to women, most who had no independent means or family to return to where they to return, were forced into sex trade. They were reviled by New York's politicos, but visited by many of the same men who decried them in the newspapers and the pulpits. Five Points was also home to the infamous gangs of New York, loose associations of boys and young men with names like the Dead Rabbits. A woman would rarely go there unless she was a dedicated social reformer, and she would definitely not go there alone without telling anyone where she was. Charles Dickens called the residents of Five Points animals. Walt Whitman, on the other hand, saw the neighborhood as nurturing the Republic's most needed asset, the wealth of stout poor men who will work. Walking alone along the same streets Whitman frequented, along the smell of roasted corn and the cries of hot corn girls, Cushman would have heard music spilling out onto the street from nearly every bar and public house, and a new kind of percussive dancing born in Five Points called tap. When she got thirsty, she could buy a lemonade or shandy from a German street vendor or eat cheap oysters shucked in front of her eyes. Cushman stayed in Five Points for several days, and when she emerged, she had traded her clothes with a dying prostitute. These rags became her costume for Nancy. The night of her first performance, she hid in her dressing room and emerged fully transformed. But it was what she did next that amazed everyone. Nancy's death scene was usually played off stage, Bill Sykes would pull her off stage and the audience would hear only the simulated sound of a gunshot. But Cushman's Nancy wasn't going to go like that. She had planned with her co-star to perform Nancy's death on stage. Sykes dragged her around by her hair, the audience screaming at him to let her go. He beat and abused her, but Cushman bloodied fought back. With her powerful physique, it would have seemed impossible that she might overcome her attacker. And Dickens' story was only a few years old, so many in the audience would not yet know her fate. When Sykes finally killed Nancy on stage in full view of the audience, the sound was like a Handel festival chorus, wrote the journalist John Hollingshead in his memoirs, deafening and rising as one to curses Sykes and wail for poor Nancy. Cushman had done the impossible. By studying the prostitutes of Five Points, she had seen them as real, pitiable women. And now she got the audience to see them that way as well. She transformed Nancy from a slattern into a martyr. Method acting is experiential. To do it well, actors need to construct an often fragile bridge between their own emotions and their characters. Actors who excel at method acting tend to seek out difficult experiences, and the method, as it is known, now has the bad reputation of licensing some actors' substance abuse and even violence. Journalist and stage director Isaac Butler, author of a forthcoming book on the topic, points out that defining the method is tricky business. "There's no consensus definition of the method," he told me in an interview. "It shifts over time pretty radically." "We usually think of the method," Butler notes, "as an Americanized version of the techniques of Russian actor, director, and artist Konstantin Stanislavsky at the Moscow Art Theater in the late 19th and early 20th century. But our definition of it always shifting, and how we define it today is not how Stanislavsky would have defined it. Today we think of the method as a practice of deep research in which you live the life of the character." Cushman's approach to acting is one of the very earliest examples we have of the method in America, the most comprehensive and true to what later became known as Stanislavskian naturalism. Edwin Forrest, the bombastic 19th century actor whose sexy legs were compared by contemporary critics to Hercules, boasted that he took inspiration from a near-death experience when he fell overboard on a boat. He claimed he was almost eaten by sharks. Cushman, on the other hand, began studying and mimicking people. As a child, she got in trouble for copying the mannerisms of her pastor while he was over at her house having tea. As an adult, she drew all kinds of people to her, from bureaucrats to Bowery boys. Her first time playing Nancy was the first time we see her consciously risking her safety to study for a role. Stanislavsky believes, says Butler, that actors play a human being, not a character type. You're not playing the romantic tragic hero. You're playing Juliet as a real person. By the time Cushman came on the scene, audiences were sick of seeing these types replicated again and again. She gave them something entirely new. Cushman went on to play mostly male roles, like Hamlet and Macbeth, and these are what made her famous. Women had played men on stage before, but Cushman was totally believable, a better man than most men, as one critic put it. This was more than just a testament to her acting. Offstage, also, Cushman played Romeo to the many women she fell in and out of love with. She was criticized for looking ugly and manly, and her co-stars sometimes complained that her physical power made them appear weak. But to audiences, she embodied what they felt a man should be: passionate, sensitive, courageous, and truth-telling. And these were characteristics she tried to embody offstage as well. She often dressed as a man offstage, but not for public appearances, and she lived openly with female partners, although the 19th century press insisted on calling them her friends. Ultimately, Cushman's ability to make her characters real and immediate made audiences fall in love with her. By the time she died, she was one of the most famous people in the world. Tens of thousands of people held a candlelight vigil on the streets of New York, as many as mourned Charles Dickens. And in Boston, thousands more crowded outside the church where tickets for the funeral had long ago sold out. They weren't just saying goodbye to a celebrity, though. They were celebrating the woman who helped define American culture as something rich, complex, and fluid. These trends would reverse themselves with the Victorians, but Cushman's legacy continued in the artists and activists she inspired. Next, we'll move on to an article from SmithsonianMag.com called How Urban Design Can Make or Break Protests by Peter Schwartzstein. Cities' geography can aid, underscore, discourage a protest movement's success. If protesters could plan a perfect stage to voice their grievances, it might look a lot like Athens, Greece. Its broad, yet not overly long, central boulevards are almost tailor-made for parading. Its large, parliament-facing square, Syntagma, forms a natural focal point for marchers. With a warren of narrow streets surrounding the center, including the rebellious district of Exarchaea, it's often remarkably easy for demonstrators to steal away if the going gets rough. Los Angeles, by contrast, is a disaster for protesters. It has no wholly recognizable center, few walkable distances, and little in the way of protest-friendly space. As far as long city activists are concerned, just amassing small crowds can be an achievement. There's really just no place to go. The city is structured in a way that you're in a city, but you're not in a city, says David Adler, general coordinator at the Progressive International, a new global political group. Well, a protest is coming together of a large group of people, and that's just a counter to the idea of LA. Among the complex medley of moving parts that guide protest movements, urban design might seem like a fairly peripheral concern. But try telling that to demonstrators from Houston to Beijing, two cities that have geographic characteristics that complicate public protest. Low urban density can thwart mass participation. Limited public space can deprive protesters of the visibility and hence the momentum they need to sustain themselves. On those occasions when proceedings turn messy or violent, alleyways, parks, and labyrinthine apartment buildings can mean the difference between detention and escape. Recent unrest across the United States has merely underscored the geographical significance, while also showcasing the ways in which unsatisfactory built environments can fuel ostensibly unrelated grievances. Cities with reduced or tightly regimented public spaces, like New York, have seen some of the fiercest clashes as police move to enforce curfews and other restrictions. Cities with few natural assembly points and massive sprawl, like Phoenix, have often prevented residents from congregating in consequential numbers at all. Boxed into largely subdivided neighborhoods, cities with partially pervasive enduring racial segregation, like Minneapolis, appear extra susceptible to protest in the first place. When you want to stage a protest, you have to identify a location. You have to think about access and even how big it is, says Jeff Hu, a professor at the University of Washington and director of its Urban Commons Lab. Sometimes people are conscious of these limitations, sometimes less so, but if you're protesting, urban design will come in somewhere. The nature of public space has, of course, always been intensely political, and in some ways, contemporary protest is just the latest chapter in a millennial-old tussle between rulers and the ruled. Ever since humans first coalesced in cities around 4000 BC, urban design has largely reflected prevailing power structures and priorities, with all the knock-on consequences for ordinary people that comes with them. The agora of ancient Athens, where citizens assembled in the shadow of the Acropolis, was an expression of early democracy. The public execution grounds at Tyburn in London, where many English prisoners were executed until the late 18th century, symbolized state control. Most famously, Paris was partly redesigned by Baron Haussmann from the 1860s to facilitate troop movements through a historically irascible city, as well as modernizing and beautifying the medieval core. It's largely his design that tourists admire today. But what's notable, perhaps, about the ongoing protests in the U.S. and many abroad is the extent to which differing urban designs can determine a movement's success, and sometimes even propel different outcomes for the same grievances. In Western American cities like Las Vegas or Salt Lake City, where the car is king, protests still struggle to gain traction among dispersed neighborhoods and vast, easily policed freeway networks. How, for example, are marchers to march or demonstrators to launch sit-ins when they must negotiate such mundane concerns as recovering distant parked cars or lack accessible and symbolic spots to target? It's consequently often only on the freeways themselves, as after the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012, the people feel able to make their presence felt. Intersections are the closest thing we have to town squares. So protesters know that block by block they need to get to them, says Stefano Block, a cultural geographer at the University of Arizona, an author of Going All City, Struggling and Survival in LA's Graffiti Subculture. In doing so, they're also taking the streets away from cars and taking them back for people. The protesters appear to have overcome these geographic barriers to gather in strength within many neighborhoods is perhaps a testament to the current depth of feeling. On the East Coast, protesters often face different, if sometimes equally debilitating, challenges. Because while they might enjoy superior mass transit, more densely populated neighborhoods and less cumbersome distances, they frequently lack access to large or usable public land. In other words, it can be easier to spark the kind of spontaneous mass gatherings on which large demonstrations generally rely, yet every bit is tricky to sustain them beyond the initial trigger. New York's Occupy Wall Street in 2011 was a case in point. Protesters ultimately struggled and aggressively enforced restrictions on the use of nearby Zuccotti Park, one of the few substantial open spaces in the financial district. Across the world, and through frequent uprisings that have characterized much of the past decade, it's often been a similar story of urban geography as a protest aid and obstacle. The initial success of Arab Spring revolutionaries in Cairo in 2011 might be explained in small part by the city's relatively compact size. Around 75% of its 20 million plus people live within 9 miles of Tahrir Square. David Sims, an expert on urban Egypt, writes in Understanding Cairo, meaning it remained largely accessible by foot even after roads and rail were shut down. The expansive nature of Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, seemingly stymied security forces last year as they tried and ultimately failed to scatter opposition to Omar al-Bashir, the country's longtime dictator. No matter how many open spaces they cleared or squares they blocked off, there were always somewhere for crowds to assemble. Conversely, the ongoing protests against Algeria's ossified regime appeared to have suffered from inhospitable urban topography. With steep hills, narrow downtown streets, and few large central squares, the capital city of Algiers has done its disgruntled residents no favors. It's just not made for protesters, says Kahina Bouagache, an Algerian lawyer, NGO director, and women's rights activist. This is the structure of the city. It's 60% hill. The state may have found it easier to weather public fury as a consequence so far. Few planners seemingly set out to protest-proof cities from the outset. But mindful of the impact of design, authorities have seldom been shy about re-engineering urban areas to protesters' disadvantage. Municipal officials in many Western countries have turned over tracts of land to private developers, many of whom have made their use contingent on highly restrictive rules. That became starkly apparent when London's Occupy chapter tried and failed to establish itself on several POPs, privately owned public spaces, before settling on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. Myriad states have reworked traditional rally points so as to inhibit the emergence of large crowds. Among them, Erdogan's Turkish state has transformed Istanbul's Taksim Square with barriers and beefed up police presence 7 years after it was the centerpiece of the Gezi Park protests. Most jarringly of all, perhaps, there's Washington, D.C. Its broad avenues and enormous open spaces were intended as a kind of counterpoint to Europe's more cloistered cities, but onerous restrictions since 9/11 have changed much of that. New sunken walkways around the Washington Monument have broken up much of the space around its base, where large crowds often congregated in the past. New walls, new fences, and new barriers have isolated protesters from key government structures. Just initiating a legal protest on the National Mall has become tougher than ever. In theory, you need a permit, and it's a very convoluted process, so if you're going to try to organize it, it's difficult to pull off from that perspective, says Lisa Benton Short, a professor of geography at George Washington University and the author of The National Mall, No Ordinary Public Space. More than ever, I think the National Mall represents a protest landscape, but it's certainly harder. Unwilling to countenance any risk at all, the most uncompromising of authoritarians have gone to even greater lengths to shield themselves from protest power. The Burmese military junta transferred the country's capital out of the bustling Yangon and into a grandiose, lightly populated new city a decade ago, a move that observers interpreted as at least partly motivated by security considerations. Egypt's military dictatorship, haunted by its experience of the 2011 revolution, is doing the same in the desert. Other regimes have embraced their own carefully calibrated rally spaces. These days, if you see a mass gathering in Istanbul, it's most likely to be at Yenikapi Square, where the ruling AKP has held million-man gatherings. Still, in the perennial contest between the state and dissatisfied citizens, protesters haven't stood idly by either. Protesters in Hong Kong have learned to congregate in small groups, dispersing and then gathering elsewhere as soon as the police arrive. Protest organizers elsewhere have learned the importance of emphasizing turnout size. In a nod to the power of optics in a hypermedia age, large open spaces have taken on an even greater significance, especially among groups that might have previously shunned easily dispersed protest grounds. To be seen is to be heard, Block says. Chafing at the increasing difficulty of congregating around traditional focal points like state capitals, U.S. protesters also appear to be seeking out new symbolic sites. Ever since George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, crowds have frequently gathered near the crime scene. After decades of tightening constraints in which public space has shrunk, shifted, or vanished, scholars suggest that urban design itself will only become even more of a protest influence in the coming years. If anything, the pandemic and subsequent lockdowns have merely hammered home to the importance of these areas. There's been this gradually diminishing role of public space in public life, adds Jeff Hu. With Occupy, with BLM, what you're seeing is kind of a reawakening. It's almost a kind of pendulum, and it's swinging back. Next, we'll move on to an article titled, A Submerged 7,000-Year-Old Discovery Shows the Great Potential of Underwater Archaeology, by Megan Gannon. Stone tools scattered on the seafloor mark the oldest underwater site ever found on the continent. Australia has a deep human history stretching back 65,000 years, but many of its oldest archaeological sites are now underwater, and an encouraging sign that Aboriginal artifacts and landscapes may actually be preserved offshore. Archaeologists have discovered a 7,000-year-old site submerged along Australia's continental shelf, the first of its kind. Their discovery is outlined today in the journal PLOS-1. At the end of the last ice age, about 12,000 years ago, when glaciers melted and sea levels rose, waters inundated one-third of Australia's habitable land. As part of a project called the Deep History of Sea Country, Jonathan Benjamin, a professor of maritime archaeology at Flinders University in Adelaide, led a team that searched for submerged sites off of Murujunga, also known as the Dampier Archipelago, a dry and rocky coastal region in northwestern Australia. This area has a wealth of inland archaeological sites, including more than 1 million examples of rock art. About 18,000 years ago, the shoreline of Murujunga would have extended another 100 miles farther than the current coast, but Benjamin and his colleagues had little to go on when they began to search the offshore territory. "We were going into an area completely cold in terms of the probability of discovery," Benjamin says, "so we just figured if we could throw every bit of technology and a lot of smart people at the problem, after 3 years, we should come up with something." At first, the team used LIDAR-mounted airplanes and sonar-equipped boats to scan the shallow seas around the Murujunga for places that might have right conditions for preservation of artifacts. They ruled out areas where the seabed is covered in lots of shifting sand, for example. Last year, divers suited up in scuba gear to survey the identified targets. The first few sites delivered no finds. Then came Cape Brugier's Channel. Chelsea Wiseman, a doctoral student at Flinders University, recalls swimming through turquoise water when her colleague, John McCarthy, grabbed her fin and showed her an igneous rock stone tool. "The first one he handed me was just unmistakably a lithic artifact," Wiseman says. "Then we found four or five others." The team ultimately found 269 stone artifacts at Cape Brugier's Channel, buried under about 8 feet of water. The various tools appeared to be designed for activities like scraping, cutting, and hammering, and the researchers found one grindstone that may have been used for crushing up the seeds of spinifex grass for breaking into bread. Based on radiocarbon dating and an analysis of when this spot became submerged, the researchers think the artifacts are at least 7,000 years old. The team also describes a second site, Flying Foam Passage, a freshwater spring about 45 feet below sea level, and at least for one stone tool that's at least 8,500 years old turned up. "A lot of our understanding of Australian indigenous archaeology is based on sites that would have been significantly further inland," Wiseman says. "This discovery will help indicate that there is more to be found offshore." Marine geoarchaeologist Nicholas Fleming of the UK's National Oceanography Centre, who was not involved in this study, says archaeologists are particularly interested in studying the northern and northwest coast of Australia. Sites like Cape Brugiere's Channel may contain evidence that tells scientists more about the people first crossed the sea from Southeast Asia to arrive in the continent and how they lived in this now sunken coastal environment. The discoveries by Benjamin's team provide the first clues to answering both these questions and show that the material does survive on the seafloor and can be discovered and analyzed as accurately as archaeology on land, Fleming says. Fleming adds that this study marks the first time any marine sites older than 5,000 years have been found in the tropics. Most submerged prehistoric sites are discovered by random chance, he says, by trawlers, dredgers, or divers who then report the sites to conservation authorities. The discovery proves that stone tools do survive on the seafloor in tropical environments, Fleming says. Though these undersea sites are vulnerable to coral growth, algae, mangroves, cyclones, and other threats. It's really an exciting find, and it just continues to push the idea of submerged continental shelf sites to the forefront, says Amanda Evans, a marine archaeologist with Graham Papp Heritage Consultants in the U.S., who also wasn't involved in this study. Even up until 10 years ago, there was just a handful of people who are really actively engaged in this work. These types of discoveries get more people involved and talking. Indeed, while marine archaeology has long been focused on shipwrecks, the last decade has seen a rising interest in more ancient sunken landscapes with subtler features. The amount of submerged continental shelf around the world constitutes an area the size of Africa, meaning a lot remains to be explored. Benjamin and his colleagues documented the world's oldest seawall at a 7,000-year-old site off the coast of Israel. Other teams are exploring the west coast of North America, searching for sites that may settle long-standing debates about how humans first populated the continent. Evans just got back last week from a six-day expedition in the Gulf of Mexico, where 40 million acres of land that were dry 12,000 years ago is now underwater. She and her colleagues took 40 core samples from the underwater settlement they plan to analyze for archaeological material. Benjamin hopes the finds from Murrayunga will impact public policy regarding maritime heritage in places like Australia that have a lot of offshore energy development, but haven't given much protection for underwater landscapes with indigenous archaeology, in part because they haven't been documented yet. We have a situation in Australia where a shipwreck that's 75-year-old is given automatic protection, but to protect a site of 7,000 years old, we have to ask for ministerial approval. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.